all. The first case for argument is Boyd versus Illinois State Police. Mr. Sanchez.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, Jorge Sanchez for plaintiff's appellant. I'm going to discuss first the jury question issue. In 1991, Congress amended Title VII to create a new means for plaintiffs to establish liability for race discrimination in a Title VII case. By enacting 42 U.S.C. 2000E-2 parentheses N, Congress created this new method aside from the previous McDonnell-Douglas method of proving liability. The statute states as follows: except as otherwise provided in this title, an unlawful employment practice is established when the complaining party demonstrates that race, color, religion, sex, or national origin was a motivating factor for any employment practice, even though other factors also motivated the practice.
But Mr. Sanchez, I thought that the state's response to this point in your argument was in part that they were never addressing this as a mixed motive case, that they said race had absolutely nothing to do with the way this whole merger, if you will, of the two departments occurred. So that's kind of my first point. The second is, bearing in mind that we look at jury instructions as a whole and that this was not the only thing, how significantly different is this from the language in Reeves, which where the Supreme Court said you have to see if the protected trait actually played a role in the decision-making process and had what they used as a determinative influence on the outcome. There are many words we can use that all kind of reach the same general end, and the district court's instruction never said it had to be the thing. It said a catalyst, a
no, Your Honor,
factor.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Your Honor, that's actually the crux of the matter here, is that the jury, the court's instruction actually did say a the catalyst. The instruction said to be a motivating factor, the forbidden criterion must be a significant reason for
a
the employer's action.
Reason.
That's fine. But then it goes on and says it must make such a difference in the outcome of the event that it can fairly be characterized as the catalyst which prompted
right,
the employer
the
to take the
question is why
effort.
Is that different from having a determinative influence on the outcome? Not an influence, but a determinative.
Reeves is an ADEA case. It is not a Title VII case. The ADEA does not have a motivating factor method of proving liability, nor
Look,
does the ADA.
I don't understand what M does except shift the burden of proof to the defendant on causation. So isn't that your complaint that the burden was shifted?
There's two complaints, Your Honor. One is that they misstated the law by saying that it had to be the catalyst.
Well, forget that. It's just words. The question is that if the jury is left in doubt about causation, then it rules for you. Now, is that what the instruction does, that it fails to shift the burden of proof?
Well, certainly, Your Honor. The other thing that the...
Don't get on to the other thing. This is the thing I'm interested in.
I was going to say the other error of the...
Forget the other error. Did the judge fail to shift the burden?
Yes,
Where
Your Honor.
Is this in
certainly
the instruction?
It certainly failed to shift. The way that it did so is it's also, in addition to saying it...
Point me where are you looking at?
I'm looking
what
at
page?
The transcript. Five.
I'd like to be able to look and follow you when you speak. Now, where in the briefs are you looking at? You have critical language. You ought to tell the court where it is, where we can look at it, so we can understand your argument.
It's on page 7 of my reply brief, Your Honor. And what the court said was that not only did it have to be the factor, but it also said it had to be a factor.
Look, why did I shift the... Where is the burden of proof addressed?
This is what I'm saying, Your Honor. It says it has to be a factor
it's
with...
It's not it has to be. Who has the burden of proof on causation?
The plaintiff does, Your Honor. The plaintiff has to show that race motivated...
What did you say has to show?
It says that race could be a motivating
factor. Why does it say the plaintiff has the burden of proof?
There was an earlier instruction given to the jury that said that your verdict must be for the plaintiff and against the defendant, Illinois State Police, if the plaintiffs have proven all of the following evidence by the preponderance of the evidence. It says, first, that they were paid less, which was uncontested, and second, that race was a motivating factor in defendant's salary determination. Then motivating factor was defined by the agreed-upon instruction. And it was further defined, and it was defined as saying it was a motivating factor if it played a part or a role in the defendant's decision, and, however, the racial composition need not have been the only reason. But what the court
said, now where was the defendant given an argument to prove that
they would have made the same decision?
They would have made the same.
The defendant elected not to have that instruction.
Okay, so they didn't want the.
They didn't want the instruction. And so what we were left with was simply having to show that race was a motivating factor. And instead, what the court's clarifying instruction said, it said that not only did we have to show that it was the factor, but we had to have shown that it was a factor without which the employer would not have acted.
Okay, so actually, the only thing that's wrong with this, I'm looking into your page 7 of your reply brief, the only thing that is wrong with the second sentence, the one that says it must make such a difference, it should have been prefaced by saying that if the it would have to be reworded, but somehow to the effect that if the employer can show that he would have taken the adverse employment action even if there had been no racial factor, then your verdict should be for the plaintiff, right? That would be correct, wouldn't it?
I'm not sure about that. I think that it
really isn't the defendant allowed to negate causation by showing that he would have done it anyway?
Certainly, Your Honor, but I think that the court's instruction is wrong in two ways.
One, I wish you'd focus on the one that interests me. Now, isn't it true that if the burden had been clearly placed on the employer to show that he would have taken the adverse employment action anyway, that would be right, wouldn't it?
No, I don't agree with
that.
Why
not?
Well, because of the fact that the court was answering a jury question. And the jury question said, how much of a factor does it have to be? Does it have to be a factor or the factor? The court says it has to be the factor, and that's wrong. It only has to be a factor under the statute.
Yes, but you're ignoring the fact that the defendant has an entitlement also. Now, how should that be put to the jury?
I think that the jury could have received another instruction that said it is the defendant's burden to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that if the plaintiff has established that race was a motivating factor in this decision, the defendant must prove by a preponderance of the evidence that it would have made the same decision anyway,
okay,
even in the absence of race.
But that would be the correct.
That would be the correct.
Did you, Mr. Sanchez, when the jury had sent out its communication and the judge decided to advance this instruction,
yes,
and you objected to that?
We objected strenuously to it. We suggested to the court that the best thing that it could do was refer the jury back to the agreed-upon instruction.
You didn't offer a new instruction?
No, sir. We felt adamant about the fact that we'd worked out these instructions and that they were as close to being correct as they could be. It's agreed that there was no same decision anyway instruction, but that was because of the defendant's election. So we felt we'd adequately defined motivating factor. We defined motivating factor in a subsequent instruction. We said it had to be a part or a role, and it need not have been the only reason. So we felt that answered the jury's questions. The jury actually told us why they were confused. And the basis of their confusion was this. They said, we find that the instructions for the jury and the question on the jury verdict form ask us to decide two different things. However, they were instructed that the jury verdict form is a form for recording their decision. It isn't an instruction in and of itself. So there was no conflict. And this decision, or this question, and these series of questions should have been answered by saying, the jury verdict form isn't an instruction. It's merely a place where you record your answer as you were instructed. And the following questions said, do we need to decide whether race was a factor or the factor? That was the first question they asked. The correct answer to that is it was a factor. And instead, the court answered, it must be the catalyst. And that, I think, was the real basis and caused plaintiff's prejudice. We argued in our closing argument repeatedly that we need only show that race played a part or a role, and the rules were changed after the game had ended.
40% of your plaintiffs are white, right?
Yes.
And race played a role in their situation as well?
Yes, Your Honor. Under Title VII, Title VII covers aggrieved parties, and our theory of the case was that the state police was a overwhelmingly white employer.
That was
before they hired this group en masse.
En masse, right.
Well, but then they hired this group en masse, and they went right back to hiring about in the 90% white. That was done after this group was hired en masse. So there, you know,
I thought before the merger, the state police hired 85 new trainees, 79 of which were white.
They continued to hire even after that.
Post the hiring of the 51?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, and how many hires occurred post the 51?
I'm not exactly sure of that, Your Honor. It's probably about another 80 or so. I see that my time for rebuttal is, I'm getting into it, so I'd like to reserve as much time as possible. Thank you.
Ms. Witcher?
Can't please the court. Nadine Wicker, an assistant attorney general on behalf of the Illinois State Police, Sam Nolan, Bruce Vanderkolk, and Teresa Kelly.
Can you speak louder? I can't hear you.
Yes, Your Honor. The question that was posed to the jury was whether race played a part or a role in the defendant's decision to set their salaries as they did.
But that was, you know, if you look at page 10 of the opening brief, you see that language. But then when you look at the language that we've just been discussing, we see this catalyst and a factor without which the employer would not have acted, which it doesn't say the same thing as the first instruction and arguably tells the jury the wrong thing, since even if it's something that played a role, it's enough. I'm actually troubled by this clarifying instruction, since it doesn't really clarify anything.
The first thing about that is that the first set of instructions asked the jury to find whether it was a part or a role, as I was saying, but it also didn't emphasize the fact that it should be a motivating factor, and it left out a little bit of the causation of the plaintiff's
were
entitled
to. How can you say that when, in the same sentence, the court is defining motivating factor? You may find that plaintiff's race was a motivating factor if the racial composition of the plaintiff's group played a part or a role in the. I mean, that's as
right.
close a link between motivating factor and a part or role as I can imagine.
Well, I think that's why the jury had their question that they sent out, is because.
So what's so first of all, if you think playing a part or a role is the same thing as a factor without which the employer would not have acted, and if so, what was Congress doing in 1991?
Well, that's part of the question that's presented by this case, is whether the split between pretext and mixed motive cases was changed by the 1991 amendments, and courts have slowly been.
I don't understand that. It seems to me if any issue of causation is injected into a case, that makes it a mixed motive case. That is, it means there are two possible causes for what happened. One is an innocent cause, one is a guilty cause. So you can call that mixed motive. So I don't see what distinguishing between mixed motive and pretext means.
Well, for example, in this case, the way that the case was presented to the jury was that the plaintiff said that race played a motivating factor in the decision, and the defendant's strategy was to counter that with saying it played no part whatsoever. The defendant chose not to say that even if it played a part.
Sure, but in an ordinary tort case, the plaintiff has to prove both breach of duty and causation. And in this Title VII case, he only has to prove a breach of duty, and then some diminished causal effect. And then you have a chance to come back and you show that it would have happened anyway. So that's fine. But this supplementary instruction upsets that pattern by requiring the plaintiff to prove the full causal consequence.
Well, that was, like you said, the theory that was presented to the jury, and many cases have said you have to look at how the case, given the evidence and the testimony and the theory of the case that was presented.
No, that's not true. The theory that presented the case, or the approach, was that all the plaintiffs had to prove was the motivating fact. Now, what I would understand that to be, to mean, is that the plaintiff had to prove that, yes, these people would have been discriminated against, paid less and so on, because of the race of the majority of them. So that's what they undertook to prove. But they didn't have to prove that because there was a competence question or other questions, other innocent possibilities, they didn't have to negate those other possibilities. But the supplementary instruction says they do have to negate those because it defines motivating factor as the only cause.
Well, it does a few things. It certainly does say the catalyst, but it also says...
And also a factor without which the employer would not have acted, which means that the plaintiffs presumably have that burden of showing that the employer would have taken the same action against them even if race hadn't been anywhere in the case. That's precisely the thing that it's the employer's burden to prove.
If we look at the instruction as a whole, it also says that it has to be a motivating factor, a significant reason, it should make a difference, and it is...
Oh, I know, but what part... Look, this is obviously a case in which the jury was troubled, and the judge gives this muddled instruction.
Well,
the fact that it has a little bit for them, a little for you, it's still a muddle, and words like catalyst really don't help at all.
The instruction that the judge gave was drawn from this court's case in Fox.
Oh, look, that's a terrible business. Taking little pieces from opinions and patching them together, and that's not any way to instruct a jury.
Well, the judge thought that was being responsive, and...
Well, it wasn't. It was just confusing.
Well, there's, as we know now from the briefing, not many cases that define motivating factor, and when you look in the context of...
one thing I know motivating factor doesn't mean is a sole cause or a necessary condition, right? Because you can prove a motivating factor and you get something for your efforts, even if it turns out that, you would have lost your job or lost your pay or what have you anyway. That's the whole significance of that 91 amendment.
Well,
all of which is muddled in this instruction.
I think if you look at the instructions as a whole, the jury was still...
I don't think it makes any sense to say to the jury they have to put together this muddle. You have the original instruction, I have this confusing thing, then I have to put it together and create an intelligible whole. That's not realistic, and what, did they take 10 minutes or something to do that?
Yes.
That's bizarre, right? They get this, you say they have to treat them as a whole, so they get this confusing instruction, then you say in 10 minutes they went through some analytical process to mold it into with the original instructions and create some sensible standard that they applied? That's ridiculous, isn't it? 10 minutes?
They did deliberate for almost 3 hours before.
Well, yes, but then they get this monkey wrench thrown into the machinery, and then they have only 10 minutes to make sense of it.
Perhaps, I mean, we don't know, but perhaps they had fleshed out, you know, the way even their question is formed, they seem to have kind of an answer in their head depending on, you know, what they're instructed on, so we don't know.
But if they're then told the wrong thing, they say, is it a factor or the factor, and they get the information, it's a factor without which the employer would not have acted, they say, okay, we understand that, it's the factor, and they haven't shown that, boom, you know, back they come. So if they're told the wrong thing, it may be very easy to resolve it, but we can't have much confidence in the result.
Well, and under the law, we need to take the instructions in the whole and assume that the jury did that as well, and they're instructed to do so.
We say that, but usually that means something other than flat contradictions within jury instructions will be properly resolved by the jury, since we hope that the judges won't do that.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we also need to look at what prejudice resulted from.
Yeah, you might want to address that for a minute, because I'm not sure you're going to get too far on this instruction.
If we looked at the evidence that was presented to the jury regarding whether there was race discrimination, the evidence would not compel a reasonable jury to find that the defendants intentionally discriminated against the plaintiffs in how they set their salaries. We have some statistics that were in the record, we have nothing that compares those statistics to the pool of forensic scientists that were available. And also,
well, are you saying the case shouldn't have gone to the jury?
Yes, Your Honor.
You should have been entitled to judgment.
Yes. There was just not evidence here to show that there was any race discrimination whatsoever, that race played a factor, let alone a motivating factor. And
have you made Rule 50 motions?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. Both after the close of the plaintiff's case and after the jury was deliberating. And those are cited in the brief, mm-hmm. The record cites. Unless this court has any further questions regarding this issue or the other two issues in the brief, I will stand on my brief.
Right.
And ask that you please affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Ms. Fisher. Mr. Sanchez. Have a few brief points to make. One is that the Foster case that's cited by the court is an ADA case, which again does not have a motivating factor standard for proving liability.
Mr. Sanchez, I have a question for you that goes to this essentially harmless error point. Is there any evidence that when the Illinois State Police took in new people, they looked at anything but salary levels? Had they ever? I mean, basically, you're problem is that instead of looking at experience in a much more comprehensive way, they instead used it only for that first cut of which three categories, and then they essentially used salary as the baseline, which led to these salary inequities. But it was my impression from this record that when people joined the Illinois State Police in other capacities, it was salary.
No, that's a good question. For the most part, they tended to look at salary. However, they would make exceptions for people in many situations. They would say, what the state police said, that if they really needed somebody, they could go above and beyond the 10%. And so we introduced at least...
But still salary, though. They were trying to see, you know, well, how are we going to get X to come here if we don't pay him or her the right amount?
But if the percentage above their pre-ISP salary that we're talking about. So instead of it being limited to 10%, in one case someone got 36%, in another case someone got 15%.
So and what so you're saying is that there should have been a whole different metric, that what they should have used instead was experience, which would have meant, instead of, even to be in Category 3, you only had that 5 years, as I recall. So your 15 or 20-year people were substantially disadvantaged by that. If you were a 5-year person, maybe you wouldn't have made nearly the kind of difference, but I just didn't see that they were doing anything to these in a sense, new people, that they different from what they did to others.
Well, there was a difference. For one, the state police didn't apply the so-called 10% rule to the plaintiffs. They acknowledged that was not applied. Although
what is the unique situation of a merger? I mean, these weren't one hires one, right?
That's completely correct.
The Chicago police wanted to get out of this business, didn't they?
Yes, that's what I understand.
Right. So these jobs might not have existed if with the expansion, right?
Well, no. That's the Chicago police jobs were set to be defunct at a certain point.
Exactly.
But the state police certainly needed to hire a huge number of forensic scientists. They had 70,000 cases a year they were doing, and this CPD lab with these plaintiffs were doing 70,000 cases. They actually hired twice as many, doubled the size of the forensic science bureau in order to be able to handle all of these cases. And in terms of your question, Judge Wood, they certainly did at many times give additional consideration to people beyond their initial salary. They didn't apply the same rule all the way across the board. They had the discretion to set salaries in the way they wanted to. They had a state statute that said, consider their years of experience for setting the appropriate level of salaries. And what they did is they set the salaries so that people with 15, 17, 20 years of experience walk in the door and they're making less money than somebody with absolutely no practical experience, only 2 years of training.
What was the background of this negotiation? Could you inform me on that? I mean, did the state police, once the merger agreement occurred, have the discretion not to hire any of these 51 people?
Yes, they did.
They constituted, in effect, hires one by one, even though it was...
No, because the statute created a transfer process by which they could all be transferred en masse and not necessarily have to go through all the steps of the hiring process. So they were eminently qualified and certainly would have gotten it.
Did the statute speak to the pay differential that existed between the Chicago Police Department and the Illinois State Police General?
To the extent that it said that they should be paid an appropriate level based on their years of experience, yes.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sanchez.